Hello, I'm Demetrius Moraitis. This is number 0456, the Stuff Out program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0456. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Tim Haig Sr., who along with his son Tim Jr. won the first edition of The Amazing Race Canada a few years ago, even though he suffers from Parkinson's. Did his disease have an effect on his competition?
Parkinson's played its role. I mean, one of the things I've always struggled with is tremor. My left leg will go wacky on me, and it's tough to run sometimes, tough to get your toes off the ground, and just fatigue, plain old nasty fatigue. And there were days you just get so exhausted that you can't think straight. So it definitely played its role.
Science writer Andrew Vizakis, the night sky guy, talks about the recent launch of the Mars InSight Lander.
We've been sending spacecrafts to Mars since 1965. You know, we've landed on it multiple times. We've flown by it. We've sent rovers bouncing around on the surface. But this is the first time we're actually not going to be inspecting the surface of the planet. We're going to be actually probing the deep interior. You can consider it as the first checkup of the planet in 4.5 billion years of its existence. We're going to be taking its vital signs.
Clinical forensic psychologist Dr. John Huber is back on the show, this time to talk about classifying overuse of cell phones or video games as an addiction.
What that allows us as practitioners to know that we have to deal with this specific arena as far as the addictions are concerned, because I would treat that differently than I would treat, say, an alcoholic who has an alcohol addiction. And I think that specificity and that level of specificity is significant, because we're not talking about somebody who just plays lots of video games. We're talking about somebody whose life is being destroyed because they play so much on those video games.
And of course, there's lots and lots of Stuff File news coming your way, and an idiot of the day, so stay tuned for that. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0456, was Demetrios Moraitis, a Stuff File program listener in Montreal and also a fine, fine musician. Thank you very much, Demetrios, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is fan-funded, listener-supported radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Now, I'm going to assume that many of you don't know that urine can explode. More specifically, that urine can explode when you're heating it in a microwave. Now, beyond the sheer curiosity of it, you're probably wondering why someone would be heating urine in a microwave to begin with. Well, let's ask 26-year-old Angelique Sanchez in Colorado for her explanation. Here's what happened. An employee at 7-Eleven in Aurora, Colorado, told police that a woman put a container in the microwave, which exploded with a large bang. The employee, who went to check if there was something wrong with the microwave, found it dripping with urine. The employee confronted the woman, who was later identified as the aforementioned Angelique Sanchez, and ordered her to clean up the mess. Sanchez pushed the contents onto the floor and left, and the employee called the police. According to the police report, officers located the woman at a health clinic at about a half a mile away from the 7-Eleven. Sanchez was waiting for a physical and urinalysis tests for a potential job. It is believed that Sanchez was in possession of someone else's urine in order to use it to pass the test. Now, before arriving at the clinic, she wanted to warm it up to body temperature, and apparently she thinks body temperature is 220 degrees Fahrenheit. Anyway, Sanchez, who has prior arrests, received a citation for damage of property for the microwave, which is worth about $500. You know, I really, really, really wanted to make her the idiot of the day, but that would have meant we would have had not one but two pee-related idiot stories 2 weeks in a row. That's just too sad on too many levels. And by the way, if you missed last week's, go back and listen because it really is urinal goodness.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
This is an important self-serving promotional bulletin. My book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars, is still available. And like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer. Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner. Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar. A host of TV icons, plus two guys who left their footprints on the moon. Order it now. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and for your e-reader on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. All links are on our website at TheStuffFile.com. So, buy the book. What are you waiting for? This has been an important self-serving promotional bulletin.
I love you. Now, back to our show.
55-year-old John Bradley Kane sued the Hooters restaurant in Madeira Beach, Florida, because he says the O fell off the company's sign in November of 2017 and hit his foot, causing injury. He asked for insurance benefits to the tune of $225,000 for medical expenses and pain and suffering. It's not likely he'll collect, though. Surveillance video shows that the O was blown down by Hurricane Irma the month before and was still lying on the ground when Kane found it. The video even shows him picking it up and carrying it to the door. Kane was arrested and charged with insurance fraud. Wow. Trying to scam Hooters. You know, Kane really should have kept abreast of the news about Hurricane Irma. Now his plan is a bust. 29-year-old Evelyn Washington broke, then crawled through a window in a Monroe, Louisiana home on April 17th, then settled into a warm bath with a bag of Cheetos and a large plate of food within reach of the toilet lid. When the homeowner returned from work around 5 p.m., she called police, who removed Washington to the Ouachita Correctional Center, where she told them an unknown male told her to break into the victim's residence.
Calgon, take me away.
Only Calgon creates this luxurious world to make you silky all over with rich moisturizing foams and pampering powders. Let Calgon take you away.
It's not just Calgon, but also the police who took her away. Meanwhile, on April 4th, a homeowner in the Longton area of Stoke-on-Trent, England, returned home to discover a man bathing in his tub and enjoying a cup of OXO broth. When police arrived, the 36-year-old naked man tried to flee but was caught and arrested. The homeowner complained, "He ate me crisps, had 5 rounds of corned beef and sauce, ate a jar of pickles, and 2 ice creams and a can of Coke." Well, that just sounds like the worst Motel 6 commercial ever.
I'm Tom Baudet for Motel 6, and we'll leave the light on for you.
No. No, we won't. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Tim Haig has been through a lot. After starting a family and flourishing in his career as a nurse, at the age of 46, he was diagnosed with early-onset Parkinson's disease. But Tim isn't one to give up. Just 3 years later, he and his son won the inaugural edition of CTV's The Amazing Race Canada. Parkinson's has forced him to retire, but now he works with charities to help promote Parkinson's awareness. He's also written a book entitled Perseverance: The 7 Skills You Need to Survive, Thrive, and Accomplish More Than You Ever Imagined. Tim joins us on the line right now from Winnipeg. Hi, Tim.
Hello. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us. Full disclosure, got to mention, I have been a fan of The Amazing Race since the very beginning on the American show, seen every episode, and of course saw all the Canadian ones too. So I was really excited when watching your season when you won that first year.
Well, thank you. You and my wife would make fast
friends? Because you sound like you're as much a fanatic as she is.
I'm very much so. Now, I'm just curious. It was 3 years before you were on Amazing Race that you got that diagnosis. Were you a fan of the Amazing Race beforehand? And did you ever think, you know, when you were still considered healthy, when you weren't suffering from Parkinson's, did you ever think this is something I could tackle?
You know what? I had seen the show a bit, but it was quite honestly my wife who was the one that was super excited about it. She had watched all the American shows like yourself, and she had always said, if it comes to Canada, we're going to apply. And this was always her idea.
Wow.
She wanted to do it.
Yeah. How did you come to the conclusion, since she was such the big fan, that you were going to do this with your son, Tim Jr., and not with your wife?
Well, she made me, actually, boiled down to. But what it boiled down to was the fact that we had three kids still at home. The 18-year-old was off in Southeast Asia traveling by herself for a few months. But we had our 15-year-old twins still at home. So you find out the rules of the race. You have to be gone for a number of weeks with no contact back home. And so nobody in their right mind goes away and leaves their 15-year-old twins at home alone. So she came back and said, we can't do this, but you and Tim Jr. can. And she put forward the argument that they would love my Parkinson's. Mm. She had seen that they had done all these interesting backstories. They'd done all these other things. She said, they've never done Parkinson's, and I guarantee you, you're going to get an interview. And, well, she was right.
That sounds like an amazing woman, by the way. Just thought I'd mention that right now.
Oh, yeah, without question. I definitely married up in this regard.
Okay. Now, one of the things I've always noticed when watching The Amazing Race, I watch and say, I love the show, I enjoy the show, but I could never do the show because every once in a while something will come along that is really not in my wheelhouse as far as what scares the heck out of me. In my case, it's water. So watching that show, there are certain things I just cannot do. Going into it, were there things you had a fear of, things that were concerning you that you thought, I don't know if I can do this if push comes to shove?
Well, yes and no. There were things that I don't like, and you mentioned one of them. I'm not a big fan of water. And Tim Jr. and I had decided ahead of time that where we had the option, he would do the water. He doesn't like eating nasty things. I don't care so much about what I eat. So I said, I'll do the food challenges if need be. But from the very outset, we said there is nothing we will not do because we knew they weren't going to kill us. They weren't going to, you know, send us home in body bags. So we'll do it. We're here to win. We want to do this thing. So, yeah, whatever you throw at us, we're going to tackle.
I've had the pleasure to talk to several people who have been on the American version of The Amazing Race, some who were eliminated, some who actually went on to win. All of them to a person says that it's infinitely much harder to do it than watching it on television, that it's much harder than it looks. Did you find that as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was far more enjoyable than what I expected it to be. It was far more stressful than I expected it to be. It was far more difficult than I expected it to be. It's a tough race, but it is doable. You do it. You just do it.
Now, in your case, how did Parkinson's play a role in this, if any? Did you have bouts or times when it became problematic, or was it relatively easy sailing from that perspective?
No. It was Parkinson's played its role. I mean, one of the things I've always struggled with is tremor. My left leg will go wacky on me, and it's tough to run sometimes, tough to get your toes off the ground, and just fatigue, this plain old nasty fatigue. And there were days you just get so exhausted that you can't think straight. So it definitely played its role.
Now, as I mentioned, you had a career, you were a nurse, and you were diagnosed at the age of 46 with early onset Parkinson's disease. What was that diagnosis like for you? And the reason why I ask that question is, you know, they often say that a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. Going into this as a nursing professional, were you fully aware? Did it scare you more what the future was holding for you? Or were you able to understand it easier with what the future was holding for you?
yes to all the above. A, my father died with Parkinson's disease. B, I had been a nurse for 18 years at the time I was diagnosed, and I had looked after many of Parkinson's patients. So, yes, I was knowledgeable about the disease, and I knew how to go get good information for what I didn't know. And last but not least, it scared the living daylights out of me because I knew what the diagnosis meant long term, and was not excited about it, not in the least.
Were you worried about the idea of getting Parkinson's beforehand because your father had had it?
No. I had always known that Parkinson's not proven to be genetic. And I should point out that this was my adoptive father that had Parkinson's. So, of course, there was no direct link that I would have been concerned with. But even then, I knew that it wasn't proven to be genetic at this point.
Well, since it isn't proven to be genetic, but your adoptive father had it, could it be environmental?
Well, what we think it is we think it's genetic, or at least that we think there's a predisposition to it, and that it's likely something in the environment that's triggering it. So we're probably doing something to ourselves that's kicking it off, because more and more we're diagnosing it younger and younger and younger, and there's more and more people being diagnosed with the disease that you simply didn't see in you know, long history going back.
Mm. Since you won the Amazing Race, that's, I guess, the silver lining, the fact that you were forced to give up your career because of your diagnosis of Parkinson's. Winning the Amazing Race, I would assume, allows you to do some of the things you're doing now, including writing your book, Perseverance. What is the message you want to get out to people, and who are you trying specifically to reach?
Well, you know, the motivation in writing the book, or at least one piece of the motivation, was the Parkinson's community. That this Amazing Race experience, having run it with Parkinson's, was such a cool event. And it seemed to, no matter where I go, inspire people in telling the story, that I was motivated then to write it down and see if you can't get it out to that many more people. But what I've learned beyond that is that the story resonates with so many people in so many different circumstances, whether it's chronic illness of any kind, whether it's the entrepreneur who's stuck in his career or in his work environment, he can't get beyond this particular place. That perseverance is something that can be learned. It's when we hit our wit's end, we don't know where else to go. I've described 7 skills in the book that will take us beyond where we thought we could go. It can take us forward, and I hope that people will come away seeing that they can still experience more wins, they still can have more success in life if they will stay in their race and persevere.
In competing in the Amazing Race, and also in writing your book, Perseverance, what kinds of things did you learn about yourself?
Well, I learned that I had been taught a lot, an awful lot about perseverance unknowingly from the example of a birth mom who, you know, found herself pregnant at 20 years old, white girl, pregnant by an older black man, and who worked her butt off to make sure that I was given a shot at life. Then to see parents who are a white couple adopt 6 biracial babies in a time and a culture that simply did not accept that kind of thing, and how they persevered to give us a shot at life, to provide us with the things that we needed to be successful in life. And I discovered that perseverance had been being woven and kneaded into my life all along, and I think preparing me for the day that I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease.
Mm. And finally, having been on The Amazing Race, what effect did that have, if any, on the relationship between you and Tim Jr.?
Oh, you know what? He's such a good kid. I think the biggest thing that for me that I learned on the race was that not only did I have a good kid, but this kid had grown up into a phenomenal young man. And I found that on the race, I ended up with this teammate who was exactly what I needed. I needed that strength that comes from a strapping young man when he hauled me up a hill in the Callaway. And then he just turned out to be the compassionate, kind, patient individual that a dad needed who has Parkinson's to get through this race.
I know you go around, public speaking, and of course you're mm-hmm. doing a book tour for this book, and people, I'm sure, recognize you from The Amazing Race. What's the reaction you get from the everyday person on the street or someone who comes to one of your talks or at a book signing, for instance?
Well, I'm very pleased. It warms my heart that this story that I have been blessed with seems to inspire and give hope to so many others. And after having been given so much in life, it really is very fulfilling, very rewarding to see that we can give hope and joy and comfort and help people along their journey just a little bit.
Well, I know you talked about the relationship you have with your son, Tim, and what you think of him. I would go and one step further and say that you are an amazing role model, not only for Tim and the rest of your family, but all those who watched you on Amazing Race. And congratulations on the successes you've had since then and what you're doing now.
Well, thank you very much. I certainly appreciate that. That's very kind.
Thank you very much, Tim, for being on the program with us.
You're very welcome. Wish you all the best. Enjoy the race. Season 6 in Canada is coming up, eh?
Tim Haig, winner of the inaugural edition of CTV's The Amazing Race and the author of Perseverance, the 7 skills you need to survive, thrive, and accomplish more than you ever imagined. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0456, and you'll find links to Tim's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come in the program, Andrew Vazekas, the Night Sky Guy, is back to talk about the latest Mars lander mission. Plus, Dr. John Huber is on the program to talk about phone and video game addiction. We also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, a 91-year-old man was arrested in Richmond, Indiana, after he fired a shot toward a man ahead of him in the drive-thru line at a McDonald's. Johnny Douglas was upset at the slow-moving drive-thru line when he and 39-year-old Philip Bailey argued. Bailey, who is reportedly a McDonald's employee, then threw a smoothie at Douglas, who responded with a gunshot. Douglas was jailed on charges of criminal recklessness and pointing a loaded firearm at another person. Bailey was jailed on misdemeanor charges of intimidation and disorderly conduct. Police said no shell casing was found, but the gun Douglas allegedly used was recovered. You know, it would seem that people just don't have patience anymore. The amount of road rage we've reported on just at McDonald's drive-thrus over the years is astounding. Then again, the number of odd stories that involve McDonald's drive-thrus is also a stat for the ages. Remember back in the day when the most dangerous thing that could happen at a drive-thru was you have everything supersized? Yeah. Several men were on their way home after attending a wedding in Papadahandi, Odisha, India, and stopped near a forest for a restroom break. One of the men, Prabhu Batara, spotted a wild bear and, against strong advice from his friends, headed over to get a selfie with the animal. Batara's friends, watching from a safe distance, captured what happened next on video. The bear attacked him. Batara died on the spot, reported a forest ranger. Now, a recent study found that 60% of all selfie-related deaths in the world occur in India. Rather than kill the animal for doing what comes naturally, the bear is being treated for its injuries, according to the spokes ranger. On the other hand, angry locals demanded compensation to be paid to Batara's family, and forestry officials agreed to cough up 30,000 rupees, which is about 450 bucks US. You know, the act of taking selfies has really ratcheted up the number of Darwin File stories we have. Because even more so than ever, the tree of life is often self-pruning. State investigators in Florida jumped on the case. Someone stole four hard drives from computers at the Florida Department of Revenue in Tallahassee, containing secret information about taxpayers. A sophisticated identity theft ring, maybe? Maybe not. The trail led to 21-year-old Andrew Reed, an employee at a janitorial service that the state contracts with. According to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, Reed indicated that he had connected the hard drives to his Xbox to download video games without knowing what was on the hard drives. We are confident that the information on the drives was not accessed. Reed has been charged with offenses against intellectual property, and I bet he can't spell intellectual or knows what it means. Also charged with offenses against users of computer systems. Both of those, by the way, are felonies. You know, was he too cheap to buy a hard drive, or was he just looking for bootlegged Microsoft games? And finally, in the section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Planet Fitness customer in Saginaw Township, Michigan, was alarmed April 15th to find a Wi-Fi network named Remote Detonator while searching for an available connection. The gym manager evacuated the building and called police, who brought in a bomb-sniffing dog and declared the facility safe after a three-hour shutdown. Saginaw Township Police Chief Donald Puchel said that people often choose odd names for their Wi-Fi networks, adding that one on his own street is called FBI Surveillance Van. See, that's the kind of humor I love. I'd come up with several great ideas for Wi-Fi networks, but I'd be concerned that hackers who don't have a sense of humor would look at it as a target. So I just, you know, keep it really simple. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? A couple of weekends ago, NASA headed back to the Red Planet. They launched the Mars InSight lander from California's Vandenberg Air Force Base. To talk about the mission and why it's important, we check in with science writer Andrew Vizekas, the night sky guy. Andrew is a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of Star Trek, the official guide to our universe, the true science behind the starship voyages. He joins us on the line via Skype from right here in Montreal. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Peter.
Nice to have you back on the program with us once again. We always like to go to you because you're the one guy who knows if something's leaving the planet, why it's doing that. So this is the latest incarnation. This is the Mars InSight lander. And one of the things that's interesting about it right off the bat is it left from California's Vandenberg Air Force Base. Why is that?
Yeah, I mean, this is the first time that they're using the West Coast launch pads. To date, they've been using the Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral. It's just basically because of the physics of launching. It gets a better trajectory from the coast, basically. This is going to be the first time they're trying it off of the West Coast, and they want to keep doing that. This is something that they want to open up in terms of another launch facility. It's simple. A lot of the components for these interplanetary missions are actually built on the West Coast, and to have them, they usually have to truck them to the East Coast, to Florida. So instead of doing that, they're I think it's a big part of it is also to save money as well.
So we can Forget about the fears of any conspiracy groups out there who might be saying, oh, wait a minute, what's going on? Is NASA being militarized?
No, no, not at all. And this is the Vandenberg Air Force Base has been used by NASA to do a lot of other kind of scientific missions, mostly to look at Earth's atmosphere. But this is the first interplanetary one, and it seems like it went off without a hitch. So I wouldn't be surprised if you'll be seeing more of these planetary missions being launched from the West Coast.
Okay, so what is the mission of the Mars InSight lander?
So it's a really different kind of mission from everything that we've seen before. You know, we've been sending spacecrafts to Mars since 1965. And, you know, we've landed on it multiple times. We've flown by it. We've sent rovers bouncing around on the surface. But this is the first time we're actually not going to be inspecting the surface of the planet. We're going to be actually probing the deep interior. And this is really, you can consider it as the first checkup of the planet in 4.5 billion years of its existence. We're going to be taking its vital signs. So this is the first time we're actually going to be looking at the pulse of Mars by looking at Mars quakes, tremors, underground tremors. We'll be looking at that. And also the heat flow, how the internal heat, if there is any, how does it transmit through the underground? And this is going to give us a picture of the internal clockwork of this neighboring planet for the first time.
Unlike previous missions, you mentioned the rovers as an example. This one isn't going to be moving anywhere. It's staying put where it lands, correct?
Exactly. So the landing site for InSight mission is just north of where the Curiosity rover landed back in 2012. And so this mission is really stationary, and it's all about probing the interior, just the ground, putting in a 16-foot thermometer into the ground, hammering it in, having a robotic arm that'll place a seismometer on the ground to measure those Mars quakes. So everything is really it needs to be, this type of science that it's going to be doing needs it to be a stationary spacecraft on the surface.
And you say just north of some of the previous missions. How far north? And is this a new location as compared to others that have been there since, as you say, going back to 64?
Yeah, this is a site. Elysium Planum is a site that is actually quite boring because it's very flat. And there's some rubble, some rocks around. We've known this site very, very keenly back from the Viking missions that first mapped this area. And we've chosen that very carefully because of the fact that it's so boring. It's a safe place to land a spacecraft on the ground, so without it being damaged by any kind of cliffs or canyons or a mountainside. It ensures the safety of the landing the best we can. But of course, you know, keep in mind, Peter, that about 40% of all the missions ever sent to Mars by any country, any space agency on the world has been successful only making it there. It's a challenge to get there because of the extreme temperatures that exist there. Also, the planet's atmosphere is extremely thin, so this makes it a real nail-biter in terms of slowing the spacecraft down once it arrives at Mars, and then slowing it down enough as it goes through the atmosphere to open up the parachute. And so having a thin atmosphere really makes that an engineering challenge. And this 7-minute voyage through the atmosphere is really what they term the 7 minutes of terror for most of these missions that do land on the Red Planet.
And if all goes well, it should land by November 26th?
Exactly. And that'll start basically 2 Earth years or 1 Martian year of of functioning at least. But, you know, Peter, if you look at all these other missions that we've talked about over the years, Curiosity, Spirit and Opportunity, Pathfinder, way back in 97, these guys are like the Energizer Bunny. They just keep on going. Despite their warranty being for a very limited time, they just keep going. I mean, just to give you an idea, the Spirit and Opportunity rovers that landed back in 2004, one of them is still in operation, and it was only supposed to operate for 3 months. 90 days was what the warranty was. So missions on Mars tend to last very long time. So I think we'll be talking about InSight for many years to come.
Maybe it's a good place to send a Yugo. Speaking of which, how big is this?
It's about the size of two office desks put together. So it is, you know, it's a fairly big size. It's very similar to the 2007 Phoenix lander. It's a very similar in concept in the design of the mission. Has a robotic arm on it. Has a suite of scientific instruments designed to look and analyze the geologic structure of Mars, so that we can get a picture of its ancient history and its evolution.
This seems to be smaller than most. I mean, in the past, when I've asked you the size of a particular mission, usually you say something in the realm of it's like a small school bus. So this is pretty small.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, this is going to be one of the smaller ones that we will be sending to Mars, because the one that's coming up, next one, is a Mars rover in 2020 that NASA's sending, and that one is going to be the size of a small car. So a compact car. And so these missions are really starting to be much larger generally, because it's a setup to sending humans to Mars. So the spacecrafts, all of these components are really, the sizes are increasing as we're getting better at landing them safely. But this mission, the InSight mission, is really designed to, it's very different. It's pure science, really unlocking some of the mysteries of the red planet. And it doesn't need to be a very large spacecraft to do that in this case.
And I would assume with modern technology, as cameras get better and better and better, that once it gets there, we're going to see some spectacular pictures.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a lot of information flowing back. And actually, what's really cool about this mission is that flow of information, of data. That's always been a problem with Mars. There's sort of like a constriction of the communication pipeline between our planets. And that's because we're very limited of the satellites that are in orbit around Mars that relay the information. And that's going to change with InSight, because along with the actual main spacecraft, there's two smaller mini spacecrafts called MarsCube 1. It's two small briefcase size microsatellites that are flying in tandem with InSight and will go in orbit around Mars and allow us to send large amounts of information from the lander itself back to Earth. So we're going to be, that's going to change our complete outlook on being able to communicate with missions that are robotic now, but also eventually with human missions that will have real-time relay with the missions on the ground on Mars.
When you say orbit around Mars, are you saying actually orbiting around Mars or geosynchronous orbit?
Yeah, these are actually going to be geosynchronously orbiting Mars, and this is just the setup of multiple more satellites. These small nano satellites are really what is a boon for a lot of companies, communication companies, because they're fairly inexpensive to do. You can do massive amounts. Elon Musk with SpaceX are planning to do similar kind of internet-based microsatellites, cube satellites, putting up over 1,000 of them in a chain around the Earth in the next few years. Similar system is being thought of for Mars. So we're at, with this CubeSat technology right now, we're testing that whole ability of reinventing the communication capabilities for future Mars missions.
Fascinating stuff, Andrew. For more information on anything that you know about science, which is a heck of a lot, how can people find you?
Well, folks can actually visit me on Facebook on the Night Sky Guy page that I have there. I give daily updates on things that I find interesting that come across my desk as a space journalist. And of course, what's up in the night sky, how you can actually connect with the real sky with some of these real objects, see Mars for yourself. I help people with that on my Facebook page. Also, they can check me out at National Geographic, where I have the Starstruck column that I write there regularly, and I have a monthly sky guide as well.
Always a pleasure, Andrew. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Clear skies.
Andrew Fizakis, the night sky guy, and also the author of Star Trek, the official guide to our universe, the true science behind the starship voyages. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0456, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Imagine if a justice of the Supreme Court started allowing a court employee to issue opinions in his name. For example, what if Chief Justice Earl Warren had allowed a law clerk to write his opinion in the historic case of Brown v. Board of Education? It would have been a huge scandal. It's not allowed in the courts, and it shouldn't be allowed to happen with Congress either. Yet a respected think tank says hundreds of federal rules that have the effect of law are being written by employees of federal agencies without the approval of Congress. These rules are threatening everyone from cattle ranchers in Idaho to owners of vape shops in New York, as well as millions of other Americans. Let's be fair, this is a complicated issue, but what's happening is federal employees are ignoring the Congressional Review Act signed into law by President Clinton. That act requires agencies to send rules to Congress before they take effect, but many regulators are thumbing their nose at it. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. The best thing since sliced bread. No loafing here.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about phone and video game addiction with Dr. John Huber. We also do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on. But I got a few more Stuff File news stories I want to share with you right here, right now, here on a program that is fan-funded, listener-supported radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, authorities say a couple in Ohio was startled to find a stranger who had helped himself to leftover Easter candy and then fell asleep on the couch in their apartment. Rittman police say a 36-year-old man climbed through the unlocked window, got his sugar fix, and fell asleep overnight in the couple's living room. A male resident of the home called 911 around 6 a.m. to report that some random guy wouldn't wake up. He can be heard yelling at the man to get out of here. The man did leave and was arrested nearby. Officers found prescription medication and two knives on him. Police say the man is being charged with aggravated burglary. Rittman, by the way, is roughly about 45 miles south of downtown Cleveland. You know, this story is a classic reason why you shouldn't leave your windows open before going to bed, or for that matter, leave Easter candy out. And a man got some tar on his clothes, so to clean them, he soaked them in gasoline. Then he took them to the day and night laundromat in Logan, Utah, put them in a washer, and boom. The sound was like a bomb, said Sergio Gonzalez, another customer. Pieces of washing machines went flying. The explosion started fires and broke windows, but the building seemed to remain structurally sound. Fire Marshal Craig Humphreys chose not to identify the man with the tarred clothes. I guess that way he can't be feathered. You know, this is why an education is so vital. Simple grade school science would have allowed this guy to figure out the error of his ways before the explosive conclusion. Anyway, let's get to our last guest on this edition of the Stuff File program for this week, shall we? Clinical forensic psychologist Dr. John Huber is back on the program with us. He's the chairman for Mainstream Mental Health, which is a nonprofit organization. I thought it would be a good idea to have him back on the show to touch on two topics that deal with addiction. One is video games, the other, cell phones. John joins us on the line right now from Texas. Hi, John.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Always a pleasure to have you on the program, sir. These two stories that came out in the news, and right now I have to apologize for all my brethren in the media, because sometimes they go to this Chicken Little attitude. But having said that, the WHO, the WHO, that's the World Health Organization, not the band, they have plans. One story says they have plans to classify video game addiction as a disease. And the other story says phone addiction causes loneliness, anxiety, and depression. And I know I'm calling to you for your answer, but let me just give you my theories on this. And that is, isn't addiction just addiction? Are we just trying to micromanage these situations? A person who has addictive personalities can fall under a spectrum of addictions. Why are we blaming cell phones and video games?
Well, I don't think it's necessarily blaming that, but what that allows us as practitioners to know that we have to deal with this specific arena as far as the addictions are concerned, because I would treat that differently than I would treat, say, an alcoholic who has an alcohol addiction. And I think that specificity and that level of specificity is significant, because we're not talking about somebody who just plays lots of video games. We're talking about somebody whose life is being destroyed because they play so much on those video games.
Is that the difference between, because you mentioned alcoholism a moment ago, is that the difference between a chemical addiction as opposed to a psychological one?
Well, the reality of it is when it's that bad, we can sit there and trace all the chemical markers in your brain. It becomes a chemical problem. Your brain actually starts reacting to that video game just like it does to heroin, cocaine, or alcohol as far as the neurotransmitters and how they function. And that's why the people let the rest of their lives get totally destroyed, because they can't stop it.
Now, in that WHO study, the recent study found that 1 in 5 boys has problematic symptoms linked to gaming. Do you have any reasons or ideas as to why that number is where it is? Does it sound high? Does it sound low? What?
I think it's about right. I mean, they're not saying 1 in 5 boys has this addiction. They have behavioral problems linked to the video game. And I think that that's a pretty fair number. If those boys are not able to finish high school or finish college or keep a job and keep their rent paid, those types of things, then again, we move on to the addiction level. But the 1 in 5, I think that's pretty accurate. We have lots of people who are involved who essentially have a preoccupation with something like hockey, you know, and that is their life until hockey season's over. They don't do anything else. It's all about hockey. Now they go to work and they have a family and go to church and those types of things, but they don't miss the hockey games. Same way here in the States with football. But that doesn't mean they have an addiction. When the season's over and they're fine with that.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the sports angle, and the reason why I'm glad you did is because we're talking in the case here of boys, and there's a situation where young boys who have stars in their eyes might want to be a star baseball player, basketball player, football player, and will spend every waking moment working toward that goal. Could that be considered an addiction? And the reason why I ask that is because nowadays you can get scholarships to go to school to play video games, and that is becoming a business as well.
It is becoming a business, and, you know, it's kind of weird when you're doing activities like physical exercise that are actually beneficial to your physical body and have strong rewards cognitively, at least in moderation, for your general functioning, and we focus on that. What about all the ballerinas and the star gymnasts in the Olympics? Are those people addicted? what it comes down to is your ability to function in life in general. Do you generate revenue? Do you pay your own bills? Are you able to maintain relationships with other people, long-term relationships, significant relationships, not just one-night stands, for example?
So now that the World Health Organization wants to classify video game addiction as a disease, what does that mean for possible treatment?
Well, what we're looking at is different arenas of treatment. We can go ahead and use the cognitive behavioral that we use for just about every other type of addiction. But one of the things that we have to do a little differently is we can't get away from computers in our society. So we're going to have to approach this one a little bit differently, maybe more like some of the European models for alcoholism, for example, where they sober the person up, they get them to go cold turkey, and then they start teaching them how to restrain themselves and that you can have one glass of wine with dinner, not the whole bottle. Okay. And some people are never able to manage that, but they try to develop that during their rehab. And if they can't manage it, they can't even have the glass of wine at dinner. And that may be where a lot of these individuals end up, where they can't even have a computer for work because they'll slide over onto that video game and they're gone.
Now, the other story, as I mentioned, phoneliness, phone addiction causes loneliness, anxiety, and depression. Is that similar to what we've just been discussing when it comes to video games, or is that an entirely different kind of an addiction and is treated in a different way?
No, it's very similar, in fact. In fact, both of them, the video game and the phone addiction, have the same neurochemical pathways that heroin addiction and alcohol addiction have. And what's happening is they're being reinforced with these neurotransmitters, and it reshapes our brain into thinking you have to have that to function every day, all the time. And that's a pretty scary thing, especially when you feel like you've got a tool here that's going to help you connect with more people, and in fact it separates you from them because you're more interested in that biochemical reaction than the actual relationship.
But that theory that you just espoused on, where people feel it has them connected, people who are addicted to the situation, I think you can find a lot of people who you wouldn't classify as addicted, who also feel that way.
Well, it's all in degrees. I mean, when people are alcoholics, you know, there's a lot of people out there who aren't alcoholics who may drink too much and get drunk. Just because they're not an alcoholic, are they not going to have the same reaction?
Right. Okay, so what about, how is this one different again from the video games? Someone, as you say, can go cold turkey and not play video games. In this day and age, I mean, just look at people walking the streets. You can't see people without their phones. It's become an extension of the human body, practically. It's not exactly something you can go cold turkey on, is it?
Well, in fact, I've visited two rehab centers this week, and they both do treat the phone addiction and the computer game addiction. And the first thing you walk in when you do is you turn over all electronics to that facility, and they lock them up for you. And you go cold turkey right there on their rehab facility.
But using the alcoholics example, a lot of times when we talk about somebody who is going through rehab for alcoholism, the idea is that they don't drink again. You can't really say in this modern society that someone is not going to be using their cell phone.
Well, again, that's why I said we're going to have to start making a shift over to some of the European models of treatment. And I also think this is an opportunity and a place where something like ketamine treatment for addiction may be able to actually make headway. It's kind of hard to think that we're going to use, but we do it, and it's actually pretty successful using ketamine to treat alcoholism, for example. When you go in there and you reset certain neurological centers in your brain with the ketamine, and all of a sudden alcohol doesn't have that same effect. You don't get the gratification and the rewards from it anymore. And we can do that with ketamine. We can also do that with your cell phone using things like ketamine.
Last question. We're talking about people who have addictions generally, but what about the general population? Do you find maybe not so much the video games, but cell phones is addictive even to those who are not addictive personalities?
It is very addicting in general. I mean, everybody gets the dopamine drip from our neurocenters in our brain whenever somebody, for example, likes us on social media. And when somebody sends us a text on your cell phone, that text does the exact same thing. You get that reinforcement, and you want to respond immediately and give that back because, hey, they like you, and I felt that little smile inside, whatever, that says, hey, hello, here you go, and I want to give it right back to that person. And it becomes reinforcing, and it all of a sudden we're with Pavlov and the stimulus response mechanism.
Luckily, I'm not affected by any of this. I have a flip phone. So I'm doing okay. John, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for being on with us once again.
Thank you so much, Peter. I appreciate it very much.
Dr. John Huber, chairman of Mainstream Mental Health. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0456, and you'll find links to John's site. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
46-year-old Sean Frederick Weatherhead was a fugitive, and the FBI sent out an alert to ask the public for assistance in locating him. The unemployed tattoo artist from Western Oregon was thought to be in California and could be identified from numerous tattoos on his face and neck, including a large one that reads, Dork. And by the way, I've posted his mugshot on the Stuff File fan page on Facebook just for his visual goodness. A California Highway Patrol officer pulled a car over for expired tags, spotted Weatherhead in the passenger seat, and took him into custody. His crime? He made about 1,000 phone calls to various FBI field offices, occasionally threatening to kill people. He previously pleaded guilty to making 100 harassing phone calls to a Western Oregon sheriff's office and served 10 days in jail for that. So, that one dork tattoo, at least, seemed to be really earned. Because why, oh why, when you look like this clown and you have dork written across your neck, would you ever think it was a good idea to make over 1,000 harassing calls to the police and the FBI? Well, one reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0456. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0456. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. If you were listening to this at the same time as watching The Wizard of Oz and listening to Pink Floyd's The Dark Side of the Moon, well, it's a waste of electricity. There are some things you just can't multitask.